Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, December 21st, 2023. District Judge Roy Ferguson chooses not to seek re-election. By Sam Karras. Sam at BigBendSentinel.com. 394th Judicial District. Last Tuesday night, District Judge Roy Ferguson, who represents Presidio, Brewster, Jeff Davis, Hudspeth, and Culberson counties, announced on social media that he would not be running for a fourth term on the bench. Overseeing justice in Far West Texas has been the greatest honor of my career, he tweeted. Next stop, wait and see. Ferguson has presided over a massive 20,000-square-mile district since 2012. His court handles a wide variety of business, from felony criminal charges to family law and civil disputes. The district judge also fulfills administrative duties. Ferguson also oversees county auditors, probation departments, and sets policy for lower-level courts in the district. Judge Ferguson ended up in Far West Texas as part of a lifelong pursuit of improving access to justice. Just a few years after being admitted to the bar, he left the big city for Marfa in 1999 because he felt he could make a difference in an area traditionally underserved by the courts. I wanted to go somewhere where I felt I had more of a personal ability to serve than in Houston with the other tens of thousands of lawyers, he said. When former District Judge Ken DeHart decided to step down in 2012, Ferguson decided to run for office. It became clear that the best way I could serve was no longer going to be just the people that I represented, but everyone who came into the system, he said. Over the past 11 years on the bench, Ferguson has been involved in a wide variety of projects. He currently serves as one of five executive committee members in the Texas Access to Justice Commission, which extends legal services to the poor in civil cases. In addition, he serves on the Texas Children's Commission, overseeing the child welfare system, and the Governing Council of the State Bar of Texas Family Law Section. He has also long been interested in the intersection of technology and the law. He serves on the State Bar's Computer and Technology Section Council and the Judicial Committee of Information Technology, advising lawyers across the state on using technology in the courtroom and overseeing statewide e-filing. Recently, he's taken an interest in AI. He joined the State Bar's Task Force on Artificial Intelligence. We're working right now to create standards and recommendations to lawyers and judges for how to use and protect everyone from misuse of artificial intelligence, he explained. Ferguson has harnessed technology in more lighthearted ways, too. He's an avid X, formerly known as Twitter, user, alternating between cracking wise and educating the public about legal matters. He still identifies on social media as the Lawyer Cat Judge, citing an incident in 2021 where attorney Rod Ponton accidentally activated a filter during Zoom court proceedings that turned him into a virtual kitten. Ferguson isn't exactly sure about his next steps or whether he'll have to relocate from Far West Texas. I'm going to wait and see what opportunities present themselves and then go from there, he said. He was proud of the legacy he would leave behind as a district judge. When I ran back in 2011, One of my goals was to take a system where even the winners felt like the process was broken and failed and turn it into a process where even the losers felt like the system was fair, he said. We have put West Texas jurisprudence on the map for the very first time. Miller. Patricia Ann Renfro Miller passed away peacefully 1 month after her 91st birthday, surrounded by her children on December 9, 2023, in Houston, Texas. Patricia was born on November 9, 1932, in Corpus Christi, Texas, to Lila Gist and Grover Cleveland Renfro. The youngest of four girls, Patricia grew up in the Valley and graduated from Pearsall High School, where she was the drum major of her high school band and was voted May Queen. Patricia graduated from Texas State College for Women, now TWU, in Denton. While she was a student there, she went on a blind date and met the cutest, funniest man she ever knew, Kimball Miller, who was a student at Texas A&M. After her graduation in 1952, Patricia taught school in Austin, Texas, and was a roommate of Ann Richards, who would become the governor of Texas for a year. Confident and with a spirit of adventure, Patricia accepted a position in San Jose, Costa Rica, to teach English at the Lincoln School. This experience opened up the world for her and expanded her love of the Spanish language and all things Latin. Although separated by distance, Patricia and Kimball corresponded frequently. After returning to the United States and settling down, she agreed to marry Kimball, who had left the Air Force, to become a commercial pilot for Braniff Airways. Patricia and Kimball married in Austin on June 15, 1957. Their honeymoon was a two-week-long driving adventure in an MG convertible, traveling to Mexico City and Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. Patricia and Kimball lived the jet-set life of an airline pilot. Their three children, Michelle, Kesey, and Drew, were born while they lived in Irving, Texas. After 17 years, Kimball retired medically from Braniff, and he began a new career in commercial real estate in Dallas. Far West Texas beckoned them to begin a completely new life. In 1974, the family moved to Fort Davis, Texas, where Kimball was born and raised. Patricia once again began teaching junior and high school English and Spanish. While teaching Spanish, Patricia twice took students to Spain for 6 weeks. She also took a group to Chihuahua, Mexico. For several years, Patricia directed students in many successful UIL one-act play competitions and other literary UIL events for many years. Her favorite compliment to give those in the cast was, "That was great. Now do it again." Along with teaching and being a confirmed bibliophile, Patricia opened El Chero Bookstore in Antiques. She specialized in Southwestern and Texana books, fine jewelry, and antique furniture, especially early Mennonite pieces from Mexico. Patricia was a faithful member of First Presbyterian Church in Fort Davis for almost 50 years. After selling the bookstore, Patricia retired from teaching in 1994. Her retirement enabled her and Kimball to travel more. Both thoroughly enjoyed having their grandchildren visit them in Fort Davis every summer. Patricia and Kimball visited both their sons in Germany many times and in Italy. Patricia was a proud member and former regent of the Paisano chapter of the Daughters of the American Revolution, DAR, the Daughters of the Republic of Texas, DRT, and a board member of Casa Hogar Orphanage in Ojinaga. For many years, Patricia was also a member of the West of the Pecos Cattlewomen. Patricia was an amazing example of perseverance, grace, faith, and love of family. The greatest gift she gave her children was the gift of each other. Patricia was preceded in death by Kimball, her husband of 64 years, her parents, and her three sisters, Geraldine Dottie Martin, Eva Renfro Thomas, B.F., June Renfro McIntyre, Bill. She is survived by her three children, 9 grandchildren, and 8 great-grandchildren. Daughter Patricia Michelle Miller Browning, Brad, and their children Ben, Amber, Whitney, Michael Repking, and Sarah Brian Parker. Son Kesey Renfro Miller, Sandra, and their children Annika, Stella, and Faith. Son Andrew Kimball Miller, Heidi, and their children Rian, Kate, and Ada. Great-grandchildren include Everett Browning, William, Madeline, Lila, and Henry Repking, Oliver, Charlie, and Emily Parker. Patricia is also survived by 2 nieces, 2 nephews, and numerous Renfro great-nieces and nephews, and many Miller cousins. Patricia and Kimball were only able to remain in their home for the last 5 years with support directed by a former student and friend, Sylvestra Salcedo, and her family, Ruby and Letty Salcedo, Otto Ramos, and more recently, Erica Badagon. Loving medical care was provided by Dr. James Lukey. Many Miller cousins visited her frequently. Being home in Fort Davis provided comfort in a way that nowhere else could have. Much thanks to all of you and the community of Fort Davis. A memorial service and burial will take place at 1:30 p.m., March 16, 2024, at the First Presbyterian Church in Fort Davis, with interment to follow at Hillcrest Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, please consider making a donation to Casa Hogar Orphanage in Ojinaga, Mexico. Post Office Box 305, Alpine, Texas, 79831. The Fort Davis Higher Education Foundation, Post Office Box 1339, Fort Davis, Texas, 79734. Or the Parkinson's Foundation, 200 Southeast 1st Street, Suite 800, Miami, Florida, 33131. Photo by Hannah Gentiles for the Big Bend Sentinel. The Mariachi Santa Cruz performed historic Christmas carols, singing along with the gathered crowd outside of Big Bend Ranch State Park's Fort Leighton during Saturday's Posada before entering the historic fort. This is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, December 21st, 2023. Obituaries.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, December 21st, 2023. If you build it, they will come. By Sean Yorks. The legacy of longtime Fort Stockton Ag instructor D. David P. Berry White has been a driving force for Fort Stockton FFA and 4-H students long after his 2017 death, and the Fort Stockton School District Board ensured White's name will live on by naming the school's new Agriculture Sciences Ag Barn in White's memory. The board voted on December 12th to use money approved by voters in the 2022 bond to construct an all-new ag barn to replace the current building that some say is too old and needs to be modernized, while others believe the building is fine as it is. The board and members of the public presented both sides of the argument at the December 12th meeting. Paul Henderson spoke during the public comment portion of the meeting and asked if any of the board had been out to the barn in the last 4 months to see the animals. Nacho Dominguez said he didn't go out there for the animals. He just went out there to look around. Was it unsafe? Did you see anything, any of you see anything that's unsafe? Henderson asked. Superintendent Zamora reminded Henderson that the 5 minutes allotted was for public comment and not a question and answer session. That's a heck of a bunch of money to go build a barn, Henderson said. Do we need it versus the cost? Henderson said there are 5 hogs housed in the barn that belong to 2 different families. I don't see how you can spend that kind of money for that, he added. Some have argued that a new ag barn will help generate interest in the ag program, and Henderson said that there are 3 ways to do that. One is you have to have a lot of ranch kids who are raised that way and want to do it. 2, you have kids that would like to be involved in it, or you have an ag teacher that draws kids to it, like Mr. White. And there were others here, Henderson said, but a barn isn't going to make an ag program. During the November school board meeting, Zamora asked what Mr. White would say regarding the need for a new ag barn. I can tell you right now, I've spent probably as much time with White the last 10 years of his life as any student he ever had, and he would say y'all were crazy for wanting to spend that kind of money for 4 hogs for 4 months a year. When you got that facility out there, that's what Mr. White would think. When the item came up for a vote during the agenda portion of the meeting, Zamora started the discussion by saying that Fort Stockton is the first district he's worked at as a leader that is a property-wealthy school district, and at the previous districts he worked for, the district was truly asking for a tax increase to fund new facilities. I know what numerous individuals in the community made the statement that if we passed the bond, we were going to raise taxes. Well, for the 3rd year in a row, we dropped taxes. Since I've been here, it goes back even farther. So the money is there. What's the best decision? I'll leave that to the board. I'll give you my recommendation, but it ultimately is up to y'all. Director Crystal Perez said she had asked around to other school districts about their barns, and I feel like we've got a lot of room for improvement on a new barn, she said. Billy Jackson asked what a new barn would cost, to which Zamora responded that based on estimates he received, it would cost between $200 and $350 per square foot for a pre-designed metal building. Zamora added the current building was not stamped by an architect or an engineer. When it was made the old-fashioned way. And while I agree that some of the old-fashioned way is probably better than some of the things that happen nowadays, it is not, liability-wise. And for that reason, what I said at the last meeting is that we would have to get an engineer to physically go through, inspect, and approve, and be willing to go on the line and say, I stamp this as something that can be done and that can be repaired. Our architects that we worked with, what I said at the last meeting, ceased to work on the barn once they found out that there was no plans for it after they would do all the things we had. Zamora said the district is not going out and borrowing money and putting the district in a position that it isn't already safely in. The district isn't raising taxes. I'm talking about the most bang for the buck, Henderson added. Take the money that you allocated for this, fix that up, and the rest of it put somewhere else where it benefits more students. Dominguez said he remembered when Jackson made a comment that the reason why they stopped having hogs and livestock out there was because the barn was in bad shape. Personally, my opinion, you can't go over there and say it's a great structure just because Paul Henderson said I was on top in the rafters, Domingo said. We made a promise to the ag people that we're going to make it better, and we're going to make it where it would be a good thing that I would be glad about. I have not one kid in ag. Lopez said there are 50 students in the ag program and 3 are FFA that show animal projects. We need to figure out how to get these kids involved, Jackson added. I believe this is a scenario where if you build it, they'll come, said high school principal Kenneth Vogel. We have to ask if we think FFA is important to us, if we think ag's important to us, then what are we doing about it? If it is, then I think we look at the example that we've set for our students with our new football field, with an outstanding basketball gym, and other outstanding facilities at our new high school. And if we believe that FFA and ag is important to us, then we may need to take a look at that ag barn down the road and want to make it better for our kids. Jennifer Gonzalez moved to build a new ag barn and named it in honor of Mr. White, with a second by Kay Griffith. The motion passed 6-0. The board honored December Students of the Month, including Ricardo Melendez from Alamo Elementary, Amber Huaytas from Apache, Vian Patel from Intermediate School, James Warren from Middle School, and Athena Gomez from High School. City Council hears November police stats. The City Council on December 11th heard the monthly police activity report from Chief Ernesto Velasquez. The Council also approved an agreement with TriStar Communications for new two-station police dispatch consoles at a cost of $120,000. The Council also approved requesting sealed bids for replacement of building water well number 6 and approved roof repairs to the Fort Stockton Convention Center through D&G Quality Roofing, with Interlocal Purchasing System Purchasing Cooperative. School Board honors Teachers of the Quarter. With the first half of the school year nearly complete and students heading into the holiday break, the Independent School District School Board recognized Outstanding Teachers of the Quarter at its December 12th meeting. Teachers honored included Victor Valadez from Middle School, Brenda Gallegos from Intermediate, Cody Aaron from High School, Paola Gutierrez from Apache Elementary, and Denise Crenshaw from Alamo Elementary. Middle School Teacher of the Quarter Victor Valadez is a first-year art teacher and 2017 graduate of Fort Stockton High School who has returned to his hometown. He brings a positive attitude and strives to continue to learn. High School Teacher of the Quarter is Cody Aaron, a first-year science teacher and a Fort Stockton High School graduate, who Principal Kenneth Vogel said has found his calling as a science teacher and tennis coach. Staying true to his Panther pride, he has quickly distinguished himself as one of the hardest-working teachers on campus, said Vogel. Additionally, he serves as an assistant tennis coach and helped lead our Panthers to a bi-district tennis championship and a playoff win. Intermediate School Teacher of the Quarter is Brenda Gallegos, an educator for 7 years and an intermediate school for 2 years. Gallegos is a fifth-grade ELAR teacher who also teaches folklorico dance. The Alamo Elementary Teacher of the Quarter is Denise Crenshaw, who has worked for FSISD for 15 years. Apache Elementary Teacher of the Quarter, first-year kindergarten teacher Paola Gutierrez, has left a mark on her school and community and elevated the educational experience for her students with a positive, inclusive learning environment. The board approved donations of door prizes for the staff Christmas party to include $300 from Cruz Residential Construction, $130 from anonymous donors, $500 from Triple R Welding, and $200 from Big Ben Telecom. The district also accepted a $4,400 donation from Triple R Welding for the basketball program. Donations earmarked for a specific purpose must be approved by the board. The board approved a quote of $272,344 from K-12 Designs for campus furniture replacement and upgrades, acknowledged a superior achievement rating from the Texas Education Agency for the School Financial Integrity Rating System of Texas, which ensures that Texas public schools are held accountable for the quality of their financial management practices. The system is designed to encourage Texas public schools to better manage their financial resources to provide the maximum allocation possible to direct instructional purposes. The board approved a quote from Texas New Mexico Power for $92,500 to run and install power to the new middle school football field and track.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, December 14th. Ground fractured, toxic water flowing near 2022 blowout. The story was written by Smokey Briggs. On January 2, 2022, a 200-foot-high geyser of contaminated water containing salts, hydrocarbons, and other toxins erupted from an abandoned oil well in Crane County. The well, known as CT-112, is located about 12 miles east of the Ward-Crane County line along State Highway 329 and is a few hundred yards south of the highway. Railroad Commission records indicate the well, owned by Chevron, was eventually controlled, and the flow of an estimated 40,000 barrels of toxic water per day was stopped. Last week, about 400 yards from the CT-112 well, the ground split open for some 200 to 300 feet, and toxic water began flowing out of the fracture. Railroad Commission candidate Bill Birch says that the event is a catastrophe for both West Texas and the oil and gas industry. Quote, from a well-controlled perspective, once the ground is fractured to the surface and the flow is outside of the wellbore, you cannot fix it. You cannot control it. It is the worst possible scenario. The best you can do is build levees around it to contain the water and then plug every well within at least a half mile. I estimate hundreds to thousands of acres will be flooded. End quote. As well, the toxic water is almost certainly flowing into the Permian's three underlying freshwater aquifers, the Pecos Valley Alluvial, the Santa Rosa, and the Rustler, the only sources of fresh water in the Permian Basin. Quote, this is a catastrophic event for the oil and gas industry as well. Nothing worse for the industry could have happened, and the Railroad Commission is 100% responsible. This proves what many of us have been saying, that the risk to the groundwater is imminent. The Railroad Commission failed to adequately regulate the injection of produced water, and this blowout is way ahead of anyone's best estimate of time to failure at the surface by decades. End quote. Quote, I get that the area involved is not the entire Permian Basin, but this proves events are accelerating in Reeves, Pecos, Ward, and Crane counties, and there is no easy way to fix this, he said. Birch said that simply plugging wells would not solve the problem, as the pressurized water would simply escape through the next closest abandoned well, of which there are thousands, or simply fractured to the surface, creating its own route of release. Quote, the Railroad Commission is about to have its first Superfund site, Birch said, referring to the land around the CT-112 well. By Superfund, Birch was referring to the Federal Environmental Protection Agency's Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act, which is informally called Superfund, and was established in 1980 by the federal government to deal with contaminated sites. Birch said the only possible explanation for both the original blowout and now the water flowing from the crack is the pressurizing of the underlying formations with contaminated water produced during oil and gas operations. Commonly, the water is disposed of by injecting it back into the ground at saltwater disposal wells. Birch's experience with the area, and the CT-112 well specifically, goes back to his work for the Antenna Ranch that is located partially in Crane County, and where he was investigating similar abandoned wells nearby that were flowing produced water to the surface when the CT-112 blew out. At the time, Antenna Ranch owner Ashley Watt reported she sold all of her cattle as the water beneath her ranch was contaminated and no longer fit for livestock. Birch's career in oil and gas began in the year 2000, working for Schlumberger as a junior field engineer in Saudi Arabia after he completed his bachelor's degree in chemical engineering with a minor in petroleum engineering. Over the years, the 49-year-old Birch has worked in 60-plus countries dealing with everything from well-control emergency response to firefighting to drilling, including being part of the emergency response efforts to the Deepwater Horizon blowout in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010. According to Birch, containing the CT-112 well is just a proverbial finger in the dike, and does nothing to address the underlying cause of the problem. Quote, "We knew from the original CT-112 blowout that this thing was big. That well flowed 40,000 barrels of produced water per day for days. It has to be connected to a fire hydrant of enormous volume, and there is no natural cause, no natural explanation at the relatively shallow depths of these wells," he said. "This has to be connected to saltwater disposal. There is no other explanation," end quote. Birch also pointed out that since 2009, seismic activity in Texas has increased exponentially. Quote, "Of the top five earthquakes ever recorded in Texas, three have occurred in the past 18 months in the Permian Basin. The U.S. Geological Service has confirmed the causation between toxic saltwater disposal and seismic activities," he said. "The amount of produced saltwater that is being injected into West Texas has risen dramatically since 2010 as well. According to Reeves County Groundwater Conservation District General Manager Greg Perrin, the amount averaged around 18,000 acre-feet per year from 2010 through 2017. 1 acre-foot converts to 7,758 barrels. Since 2019, that number has been north of 121,000 acre-feet, or about 938 million barrels each year. According to Birch, water produced by Permian Basin operations is only part of the problem because the Railroad Commission authorized Texas saltwater disposal operations to take water from New Mexico and Louisiana as well, since neither state will allow the water to be injected into their own ground. Quote, "Texas is the dumping ground for other oil and gas-producing states, and the Railroad Commission okayed the deal because it's good money. This is what you get when your most important industry is overseen by a man whose main claim to fame is as a gospel singer and a woman whose only qualification is being Tom Craddock's daughter," he said. Birch said that in his opinion, all three current railroad commissioners have been criminally negligent in how they have managed the industry. Quote, "So far, the Railroad Commission's solution has been to ignore this problem and to privatize the profits and socialize the liabilities. We cannot keep ignoring this. The seismic activity, the blowouts, this will eventually cause the death of the oil and gas industry if we do not fix it," he said. Birch pointed out that in Oklahoma, when oil and gas-related seismic activity threatened the Cushing Oil Storage, the largest tank farm in the world, the state shut in 75% of oil production in the state for 2 years until the seismic activity cooled off. Quote, "Texas cannot afford to shut in 75% of its oil and gas economy," he said. "Texas needs the oil and gas industry. I am a pro-oil and gas Democrat. I have worked in the industry my entire adult life. Oil and gas make up 8% of our GDP. Low-cost energy drives everything else. This is about trying to save the industry before these idiots crash it," he said. Birch said in his view, there are three broad issues facing Texas and the Railroad Commission. Quote, "First, we have to deal with the legacy stuff, the old wells. This has to be resolved by the industry, not passed along to the taxpayer. Second, we have to solve the saltwater disposal problem. There are solutions, not just as cheap as the 38 cents a barrel it costs to inject it. Third, the future of Texas hinges on oil and gas production. There is no getting rid of fossil fuels. We are going to see a tripling of our energy grid in the next 77 years, and much of that will have to be supplied by fossil fuels. There are big decisions being made by the Railroad Commission affecting our future, and I want to lead those solutions, end quote. Resident wants city sidewalk repaired. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Monahan's resident, Alan Giel, addressed the council during the public comments section of Tuesday's final council meeting of 2023 regarding the broken sidewalk in front of his home and asked who is responsible for paying for the repairs. Giel said, quote, "The sidewalk in front of my house has been an ongoing problem. It is damaged and has fallen in because there is not a curb and gutter. I have asked Mr. Covington if it can be replaced, and he said I would have to pay for the repairs," end quote. Giel told the council, "The sidewalk is past the right-of-way markers, which are on the fence line on his property, and when Covington told him he had to pay for the repairs, he showed him the right-of-way markers and the Texas Transportation Code, Title 6, Chapter 316, Subchapter A, which states the city is responsible for maintaining the sidewalks." Quote, "After I showed Mr. Covington the right-of-way markers and the code, he said I would need to pay half and the city would pay half of the repair costs. I have the transportation code right here, and nowhere in this code does it state it is my responsibility to pay for the city right-of-way," Giel said. The other concern Giel brought up to the council is his damaged fence, saying, quote, "The city trash truck driver hit my fence twice over 2 years ago and damaged it. Mr. Covington knows about this, too. He came out and looked at it and took pictures of the damage. Then, when nothing was done, I called Covington to come out again, and he said he thought it had been fixed. I want to know why it hasn't been taken care of since the city damaged it," he said. City Manager Rex Thee said, quote, "If the contractor paid for the street, curb, and gutter to be installed when the house was built, it is the responsibility of the property owner. If the street, curb, and gutter was already there when the house was built, then the sidewalks would be the city's responsibility to repair it," he said. Thee added, quote, "If it pleases the council, I would like to meet with you on this next week, and we can look at it and see if we come to any resolution on the sidewalk issue. On the fence, there should be a claim on it, and I'll review it and see what exactly was done or not done," end quote. Giel agreed to a meeting with Thee next week. Along with Thee, Mayor Adam Steen, Council Members Calvin Carroll, Ivy Valenzuela, Richard Hawkins, and Gerald Stava were present for the meeting, along with City Attorney Justin Till. Councilman Jeppy Wilson was absent. In other matters, the Monahan City Council recognized 10 longtime city employees with annual service awards for their dedication and contributions to the city. The next City Council meeting will be held at 3 p.m. on Tuesday, January 9th, in the Council Chambers at City Hall, 112 West 2nd Street. The City Council meets every second and fourth Tuesday of the month at 3 p.m. Anyone wanting to address the City Council on the topics addressed in this story or any other topic may do so by asking to be added to the meeting agenda in the City Secretary's office located inside City Hall, or by appearing at the meeting during the public comment section of the meeting, which is on every agenda. Gardner to replace Dean as County Facilities Superintendent. The story was written by Jan Cranfield. The Ward County Commissioners met Monday morning at the Ward County Courthouse at 9:30 a.m. to discuss and give approval to a relatively normal biweekly agenda. Ward County Judge Greg Holly called the meeting to order and established a quorum for the meeting. One of the agenda items was to discuss and vote on a replacement for the position of facilities superintendent due to the upcoming retirement on December 31st of Bill Dean, who will receive his 10-year service pin this Thursday at his retirement party. Clay Gardner's years of experience will be 10 years also as of this coming January. Quote, I posted the opening 2 to 3 weeks ago and only received one application, which was from Clay Gardner, who has been the right-hand man to Bill for a number of years, Holly said. Precinct 4 Commissioner Eddie Nelm said, quote, I have worked with Bill over the years, and he has taught me how to deal with contractors. I have no patience with them, but because of his examples, I am doing a better job. Bill and Clay have always been helpful with any of my projects, and Clay is the right man for the job, end quote. The vote for Clay Gardner was unanimous. The commissioners also voted to continue a burn and fireworks ban for Ward County for the upcoming holiday season due to continuing drought conditions. Most of the state has seen significant rainfall in recent months, but Ward County is still at a 575 moisture reading, which is dry and vulnerable to grass fires. In regular business, the commissioners also granted an encore easement request at the Sandhill State Park because the county owns the front section of the park. Encore is going to set service poles at this location for 2 residential houses in hopes of attracting new personnel to fill open positions. Encore is operating only at 60% employment capacity. In other business, Targa Pipeline's request to cross County Road 420, 425, and 426 south of Piute with a 12-inch high-pressure gas line was approved by the commissioners. In routine business, the commissioners approved paying the county bills, which include the Ward County payroll in the amount of $554,000. The court also approved the previous meeting's minutes, county and hospital budget amendments, the officers' reports, the treasurer's monthly report, as well as the treasurer's monthly investment report, continuing education for the tax assessor collector, and the audit for the county clerk account. All the commissioners were present for the meeting, Precinct 1, Tino Sanchez, Precinct 2, Larry Hanna, Precinct 3, Dexter Nichols, Precinct 4, Eddie Nelms, and Judge Greg Holly. The next regularly scheduled meeting will be Wednesday, December 27th at 9:30 a.m. in the Ward County Courthouse, 400 South Allen Street. Individuals who would like to address the court to ask questions or inform the commissioners of problems in their precinct or Ward County can call Judge Greg Holly at 432-943-3209, discuss their question or concern, and ask to be placed on the agenda for the next commissioners' meeting. Monahans High School robotics team finishes 7th in state competition. The story was written by Jan Cranfill. On December 1st, the Monahans High School robotic team, the Wolfpack, represented our district and region in a multi-state competition held at the Fair Park Coliseum in Dallas. The MHS Wolfpack placed 7th in the competition, competing as a rookie team since it was their first year of competition. The team competed against other high schools from Texas, Oklahoma, New Mexico, Arkansas, and Kansas. On Friday, the team and the robot Squeaky, which the students designed, built, and coded to perform certain tasks, in this case, the task was to perform the simulated surgical procedures of arterial plaque removal and cardiac angioplasty, insertion of artery stent. The students learned coding, along with designing and building the robot, which is the process of transforming computer instructions into a form of communication that a computer brain can understand. Coding tells the robot brain how to perform specific tasks. Only 5 of the Wolfpack team members were allowed on the floor to operate the robot, perform the assigned task, and handle necessary robot pit stop repairs. The competition consists of 15 3-minute rounds with 2-minute pit sessions in between the rounds. The rest of the team was the support system for the floor members. The team competed on the first day and was able to spend the second day observing the more advanced team competition. Quote, "We learned so much the day of competition, but especially the second day by watching the other teams. We also got to meet and talk to some amazing individuals," said Wolfpack sponsor and coach Michelle Hogan. On the second day, the team was fortunate enough to meet 2 NASA-affiliated aerospace engineers, one of which was Colt Stacer with the Stacer Group. The engineers, after talking with Wolfpack seniors who want to continue engineering as a career, offered to serve as mentors to the students. Quote, "Aiden Loya has already been accepted to an engineering program, and Camila Palacios will also be mentioned in aerospace engineering," said Hogan. The Stacer Group provides quality CTE, that's Career Technology Education Consulting, including P-TECH and ECHS, early college high schools models, and helps execute work-based learning opportunities with industry partners and establish summer bridge programs. Pathways in Technology, or P-TECH, at early college high schools provide students grades 9 through 12 the opportunity to complete a course of study that combines high school and post-secondary courses, enables students to earn a high school diploma along with an associate degree, level 1 or level 2 certificate, or industry-based certification within 6 years, as well as allowing students to gain work experience through an internship, apprenticeship, or other job training program. The team also met Herschel Chaya, who is employed by Texas Instruments and is a sponsor and founder of the BEST, or Boosting Engineering Science and Technology Robotics Competition. Chaya is the designer of Texas Instruments' newest calculator and rover. Quote, "Johannes Starks, executive director for BEST Robotics, will write a letter of recommendation for every senior team member interested in engineering," said Hogan. As well as promised letters of recommendation, the Wolfpack came home with approximately $1,000 worth of robotics VEX robotics tools and equipment. When teams arrive for competition, all teams are issued the VEX robotics hardware in the form of like motors, computer brains, servos, batteries, etc., to ensure a level playing field for all the competitors. When the competition has ended, the hardware is returned to the competition directors. But the robotics directors were so impressed with the MHS Wolfpack rookie team, they were told to keep all their hardware and have a step up on everything the team will need to build their next level robot when the new semester begins in January. Carter wins gold at IWAS Games. The story was written by Jan Cranfill. Zachary Carter, 2023 Monahans High School graduate and former track and field standout, was one of 22 para-athletes chosen by Move United to represent the United States in the World Ability Sport Games, held the first week in December in Thailand. Move United is the national leader in community-based sports and recreation for individuals with disabilities and World Ability Sport is the international sports organization for athletes with physical disability, and also World Ability Sport is one of the founding organizations of the Paralympic Games. Quote, I feel very honored to have been selected for the World Ability Sport Games. This was my first international competition. I have competed against some of the best adaptive athletes in the U.S., but never against other countries, Carter said. The games were held December 1st through 9th and included athletes ranging in age from 12 to 31 years old who competed in track and field events. Carter and one other Texas athlete met up in San Antonio, then flew to Seattle, Washington. At that point, the Texas athletes joined other U.S. team member athletes, coaches, medical team, and other support personnel to travel to Taipei, Taiwan, and then on to Bangkok, Thailand. In the track competition, Carter competed in the 100, 200, and 400 events. The field events had Carter qualifying to compete in the shot put, discus, and javelin throw. Carter could not compete in all three field events because they were all scheduled to take place at the same time. Carter chose the shot put event because that's the event he has participated in most throughout his school athletics. Carter started parasports in the sixth grade under Wade Gilliam and Doug Wallen. After Wendy Gumpert visited and introduced the parasports program to Carter, Terry Galindo and Brian Coker have helped train Carter while in high school. Gumpert helped to introduce and build the Para-Ability Sports Program to wheelchair-bound athletes. She visits school campuses to help young people get into the program that allows them to learn how to participate in sports despite their disabilities. Gumpert is married to Saul Mendoza, who is a multi-medal-winning Paralympic, who is also one of Carter's coaches at the state-level competition, and he was one of the international team coaches who traveled to Thailand. The first time Carter participated in national competition, only 8 other para-sport athletes from Texas were in the competition, the last national competition held in Hoover, Alabama, hosted over 40 Texas competitors. Carter is in his freshman year at the University of Alabama, where he is the first male parasports participant in track and field to represent the university. He is majoring in news media and preparation to become a sports broadcaster. When the group was not competing in the games, they visited some of the Buddhist temples and one of the biggest malls I have ever seen, Carter said. It was 3 stories high and had replicas of Big Ben and the Eiffel Tower built inside the building. Carter said, quote, the food was different, good, but not like Texas food. I tried things like crickets, snails, and squid, end quote. Zach is the son of Josh and Kelly Carter and the grandson of Sue King and Daryl and Francis Carter, all of Monahan's. Quote, getting to compete with some of the greatest athletes in the world was an amazing experience. Winning shot put and hearing our national anthem being played during the medal ceremony was very emotional and surreal. God bless America and roll tide, Carter said. Here are some obituaries that appeared in the Monahan's News on Thursday, December 14th. Linda K. Roberts, born March 10, 1942. She passed away on November 6th, peacefully. Linda was a devoted mother of 5 children and a caring wife. She retired as a correctional officer for the state of Texas and also worked at the Kentwick and Monahans in the 1980s for about 3 years. She is preceded in death by her father, T.V. Criswell, her mother, Flanelle Conkling, husband, Barry Jean Roberts, daughter, Tammy Mae Hurd, granddaughter Tasha K. Holloway. She is survived by her three sons, Ed Parton, Feldon Parton, Wesley Hurd and wife Amanda, daughter Kaynell Castle, sister Leanne Spriggs, 8 grandchildren, 11 great-grandchildren, and many friends. A memorial service was held Friday, November 10th, at Premier Funeral Services in Midvale, Utah. There will be no graveside services. It was Linda's wish to be cremated. Peyton Frank Piscina, a beloved son, brother, and friend, left this world unexpectedly on December 3rd in Alpine at the young age of 15. He was born on February 14, 2008, in Odessa. He was a sophomore at Grand Falls Royalty High School, where he not only excelled academically, but also shined as the number 6 player on the high school football team. In his spare time, Peyton enjoyed immersing himself in nature. Whether it was hunting or fishing, camping or hiking, he cherished every moment spent outdoors. Tragically, Peyton's untimely departure left an unfathomable void in the lives of those who loved him. He is survived by his loving parents, Orlando Ray Piscina and Abigail May Gehring, and his stepfather, Caterino Perez, who all cherished him beyond measure. Peyton is also survived by his twin brother, Caden Piscina. He also leaves behind his sister, Jade Perez. He is also survived by his grandmother, Catherine Gehring, grandfather, Frank Piscina, great-grandmother, Rose Brown, aunt and uncle, Crystal and Nick Martinez, uncle, Gavin Gehring, and a host of extended family and friends. A viewing was held at the Harkey Funeral Home on Friday, December 8th, to allow friends and loved ones a chance to pay their respects. A celebration of Peyton's life was held at the Grand Falls ISD Auditorium on Saturday, December 9th. Visit our website, harkeyfunerals.com, to sign the guestbook or leave a personal note to the family. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of Harkey Funeral Home.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.